Well, good morning. How's everybody doing today? Good. My name is Jeremiah. I'm one of the pastors here at CPC. I'm so glad that you're here as we continue our epic series. We're going to jump right in. Can we start off by playing a game? Are you guys open to that? Just a quick little game. We're going to play a game. I like to call it the hero game. I'm going to mention the name of a hero, and then you respond quickly without thinking hard about it from the gut, either good or bad, okay? You ready? Only like three people said ready, so let's try this again. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, good. Here we go. Superman.
Yes.
Batman.
Yes.
Spider-Man.
Yes.
Captain America.
Yes.
Iron Man.
Yes.
Samson.
Yes.
Oh. Yeah, that's what I thought. Most of us sort of think of Samson as a good hero, but I don't think the biblical narrative actually supports that idea. I don't think Samson is a good hero. Now, if having incredible abilities, incredible strength, having lots of opportunity made you a hero, then Samson would be one. But your abilities are not what define you. Your choices, your decisions are what define your life. And I believe Samson never made one choice, not one of his exploits, not one of the incredible things he does in all a scripture has anything to do with God or God's purposes. They're all self-serving. They're all selfish. He's selfish. Samson's not a great hero. Before we jump into Samson, I want to talk to you a little bit and sort of set the stage for what's happening in history at this point. So we're going to be in the book of Judges. Some of you hear the book of Judges and you get a little anxious, like, what? The book of Judges? Like, is this a judgmental book? You know, you've kind of been avoiding Judges because you didn't know, but Judges is not that. Judges is actually a book of incredible exploits of lots of heroes in the history of Israel. So it's an incredible read. In fact, today we're just going to kind of touch the tip of the iceberg about Samson. So really, you should go this week and read Judges chapter 13 to 16 and read about his entire life. It's incredible stuff. Okay, so jumping into the background of this story, Israel, a nation set apart by God for God's purposes, is in this repeating cycle of rebellion. So here's what happens. Israel, who God has called and set apart to be his people, they begin to worship idols. They turn their back on God. They begin to pursue idols, to worship idols. And then God gets frustrated about that, and he allows Israel to be conquered, defeated, subdued by their enemies. And then after being subdued, the Israelites, under the oppression of the enemy, eventually they come to their senses and they cry out to God for deliverance. God, deliver us. Please rescue us. And then God, in his goodness and his infinite mercy and grace, sends a deliverer. He sends a judge, like we talked about Gideon earlier this summer, or now we're going to talk about Samson today. So you have these judges that God sends to set his people free. But here's the deal. This cycle of rebellion usually lasts 20 years. So for 20 years, historically, we see in Judges, 20 years, the Israelites go astray, and then they cry out to God for deliverance, and God rescues them that last 20 years, and then 20 years again, and 20 years again. But this time around, when Samson comes on the scene, it's been 40 years. Double the time of the normal rebellion. Double the time of the normal rebellion. And at this point, the Israelites have become so comfortable with the Philistines. It's like they don't even really recognize that they're supposed to be different than their enemies at this point. They become really comfortable with them. They become more and more like them, and they don't even realize how far they've drifted from the God who set them apart for his plan, for his purposes. Israel is in a serious state of spiritual drift. I want you to imagine with me for just a moment. Imagine yourself on a boat in a stream, just rowing against the current. Ahead of you, the stream is calm and seemingly quiet, and with great effort, you row and you pull yourself to that place of serenity where you're on the smooth water. And you decide, gosh, I'm secure here, I'm safe here, I've worked hard to get to this point. You begin to rest in the success you've achieved, and you just sort of lay back and put your arms behind your head. You pull the oars in. And you just rest for a minute, and you take a little nap, and all is peaceful in the world. But while you sleep, unbeknownst to you, your boat begins to drift downstream. The water, though calm and quiet on the surface, is still moving underneath. And the subtle change of speed doesn't disturb your peaceful nap, but the roar of water crashing against the rocks hundreds of feet below finally startles you from your slumber. Alarmed and shocked, you put your oars back in the water. You begin to row twice as hard as you did before, rowing literally for your life. But the current's just too strong. And you're unable to fight the current as your boat goes over the edge of the cliff, heading toward the rocks hundreds of feet below. Yeah, I made this story up to illustrate a point, but I think it happens in real life. Just last week, I was reading in the news where 9 people in Panama Beach in Florida, they got caught in a rip current out in the ocean. And they're stranded out in the current. And here's the crazy thing about this story. People from the shore actually saw that they were stranded. They made a human chain and they rescued these 9 people. But out of the 9 people, 7 of them were adults. And out of those 7 adults, several of those still were experienced swimmers who knew how to swim in the ocean. They understood rip currents. So they asked them, well, what happened? How'd you guys get stranded? They said, well, we were out playing, having a blast, and it was such a beautiful day, and the sun was warm, and the water was cool, and we were having a blast, and we just got so comfortable. And about that time, one of the experienced swimmers looked up and said, oh my goodness, we've drifted way out to sea. We're caught in a rip current. And then they decided to try and swim their way to safety. And they swam and swam and swam for hours. And yet they still drifted further and further away from where they were supposed to be. It's so easy to get stuck in the currents of this world when we get comfortable, when we get too comfortable. I'm successful, at least in the eyes of the world, so I'm pretty comfortable. I'm healthy, at least physically healthy, so I'm pretty comfortable. I'm well-liked. I mean, I'm popular. People generally really like me, so I'm really comfortable. I grew up in church, so I must be good with God. I'm really comfortable. I grew up in a Christian family. I went to church every time the doors were open. I went to summer camp. I was all about God, so I must be okay with God. So I'm really comfortable. But here's the deal. If you're not moving towards, then you're probably drifting away from God. If you're not moving towards, then you're probably drifting away from God. And here's the deal. We're trained and programmed from an early age to pursue comfort, to pursue the easy life at all cost. We work longer hours. We spend more time away from our families, our wives, our children than ever before. Why? So that we can live more comfortably. We push our children and our teenagers, our college students in an unhealthy way to compete and excel in school. Why do we do that? We tell ourselves it's so they can get into the best school, they can get the best job, but why? So they can live the most comfortable life possible. And if you find that in your life, comfort is the ultimate goal of your life, then there's a good chance you are struggling with spiritual drift. You're drifting spiritually. So how do I know when I'm drifting spiritually? Spiritual drift reveals itself in your attitudes. Spiritual drift reveals itself in your attitudes. So if I want to know if I'm drifting spiritually, all I have to do is listen to the little blinking lights on the dash saying, hey, 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 hey. Your attitude is out of line with God's plan, God's purpose for your life. You might be struggling with spiritual drift. The little red flags are our attitudes that pop up. And we're gonna look at 3 of the attitudes of Samson that reveal spiritual drift in his life: apathy, entitlement, and arrogance. Let's take a closer look at the life of Samson and discover these attitudes. So Samson is the most powerful physical figure we have in the entire Bible. He's given incredible strength from God for God's purposes. I remember growing up in the South, we always had these flannel graphs of Samson, right? And Samson was always this big muscle-bound guy, all these muscles for days, right? This huge guy, supposed to be this massive warrior. But the reality is the biblical narrative doesn't support that. It's not in the Bible. I believe Samson was a regular man, unimpressive physically, yet God gave him supernatural strength. So nobody ever saw Samson coming. You didn't know he was really strong. But when you finally figured it out, he was a force to be reckoned with. And Judges 13 tells us that Samson was dedicated to the Lord from before his birth. His mother was unable to have children. An angel comes to her and says, hey, you're going to have a son, and he's going to be set apart from the time of his birth for my purposes to serve me. Look what it says in Judges 13, verse 5. It says, the boy is to be a Nazarite. So the angel tells her, the boy is to be a Nazarite dedicated to God from the womb. A Nazarite, by the way, let me explain a little bit what that means. A Nazarite would take a vow saying, I am set apart for God and his purposes. I will serve God with my entire life. And so the Nazarite vow included three prohibitions. Number one, don't drink any alcohol. No fermented drink for you. Okay? Number two, never cut your hair. Which I find that to be a real cost savings long term, right? No haircuts. It's awesome. Number three, avoid contact with anything that was dead. So Samson is going to be born. His mother couldn't have children. God is going to bless her with a son. And this son is to be a Nazarite to take this vow from the time of his birth. It says, the rest of the verse says, he will take the lead in delivering Israel from the hands of the Philistines. And I look at this and go, what an honor. This guy's set apart from before the time of his birth for God's purposes to be a deliverer, to be someone that God uses powerfully to rescue, to save, to deliver his people, Israel. Set apart from before the time of his birth. But here's the deal. You have been set apart by God from before the time of your birth. God set you apart with a plan and a purpose. So many times I feel like we get caught up in this mentality of searching for meaning and purpose in life, that we think some thing, some material possession, some number of zeros in our bank account, some number of square footage, some level of success will satisfy and fulfill our lives, will give us meaning and purpose. But the truth is, even when we don't recognize it, even when you don't recognize it, God has given you the greatest possible purpose and meaning for your life. You can't find it in this world. You can only find it in him. That's it. Even if you're here today and you don't have a relationship with Jesus, God created you and set you apart to know him and to find meaning and a fulfilled life in him. In fact, Jesus talks openly about this in John chapter 10, verse 10, one of my favorite verses. Jesus said this, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Jesus said, listen, if you want full life, if you want a life full of purpose and meaning, I can give you that life. But then he says this, there's an enemy at work here who will do anything to keep you from realizing the purpose I've set you apart for. There's an enemy here who wants to destroy my work in your life. There's an enemy here who wants to distract you. How's he going to do that? Well, he'll take your schedule and he'll just start to load stuff up in your schedule and he'll fill it up with lots of great stuff. Kids' activities, sports, school, all these different things. And he'll pile your schedule so full that all of a sudden you'll have no margin in your life for God. He'll distract you, or he'll distract you with an addiction. An addiction to alcohol or to drugs or to social media, to texting, to sexting, to Netflix. And he'll take that addiction and he'll use it to distract you from God's purpose for your life. What are the things in your life that the enemy's using to keep you from realizing the purpose that God has given you? What's that thing? Think about that thing. Write that thing down. Ask God to help you deal with that thing. Just like Samson, you have been set apart by God for his purposes. I think it's important to mention, Samson's got everything he needs in order to serve God well. But he's going to waste his life. He's going to miss an opportunity to do what God wants to do. The first attitude that reveals spiritual drift in Samson's life is an attitude of apathy. Another word for apathy is indifference. Same word, apathy and indifference. So, comfort, I believe, is the catalyst for apathy in our lives. We get too comfortable, we become apathetic and indifferent. We get too comfortable, all of a sudden, we don't have to rely, we don't have to trust in God, we don't have to lean on him because we have everything we need. We become self-satisfied. We become comfortable in our lives. We start to think things like the Israelites were, you know, these Philistines, they're not that bad. I mean, I thought I was going to hate this whole oppression thing, but I kind of like their food. I like their customs. I like their idols. I like their women. And they just get comfortable. They're not trying to get rid of the Philistines. And the cycle of rebellions that we read about in the book of Judges, they always end when God's people just cry out, deliver us. But there's no crying out here. You see, they've become comfortable and acclimated to the culture and they're suffering from spiritual drift. I think an important question to ask ourselves is, what is the cycle of rebellion in my life that's leading me to drift spiritually? What is that cycle in my own life? Maybe I become indifferent to God and his presence in my life. I know, I believe in the back of my head on some level, God is real and his son is Jesus. He gave his life for me, but I'm indifferent, so indifferent toward his presence in my life that that belief no longer impacts or informs the way I live. It's just something I hold in the back of my mind as true, but it doesn't impact the way I live my life. Look at Samson's indifference to God in Judges chapter 14, starting in verse 1. Samson went down to Timnah. Timnah's 4 miles from where Samson lives. He goes 4 miles to Timnah, and he saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife. Now here's the thing. I don't believe Samson went with the wrong motivation. I don't think he was going to Timnah saying, I'm going to find a Philistine wife. I think he was just going and he traveled the 4 miles and he kind of bumps into this poor choice, this bad decision. Because Samson knows he's not supposed to marry someone who doesn't love God, who worships idols, a foreign woman, a Philistine woman. But he heads there and he bumps into this trouble. And sometimes that's what happens to us. We walk our way into something we never expected. And bam, we're faced with a decision, with a choice. And how we respond in those moments, how we react, that's what defines us. And Samson goes and he sees this foreign Philistine woman and he knows he's not supposed to have her, but he wants her. And he doesn't respond or react in a way that honors God. So on his way up to meet with her again, he runs into a lion that attacks him. And Judges 14:6 tells us, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon him so that he tore the lion apart with his bare hands as he might have torn a young goat. Wow, this lion comes to kill Samson and Samson just kills him. Incredible exploit, incredible feat that he could take out this lion. Now remember, there's the Nazarite code, right? Which says, don't touch any dead thing. So he defended himself. He killed the lion. That's good. He's going to leave it there. But that's not what happens. We see Samson's disregard for God again in Judges in verse 8. Sometime later, he went back to marry her. So now, not only did he travel the 4 miles, he bumps into a bad decision. He decides to follow it through. He goes back. He's going to marry her. He turned aside to look at the lion's dead carcass. So hopefully look, but don't touch. He's put himself in a precarious spot here. And then in it, he saw a swarm of bees and some honey. He scooped out the honey with his hands and ate it as he went along. When he rejoined his parents, he gave them some, and they too ate it. But he didn't tell them that he had taken the honey from the lion's carcass. Really interesting moment in this story. Samson is so indifferent toward the things of God. God's law no longer bears any impact, anything in his life. He's taken this Nazarite vow. It no longer means anything to him. And this is truly a dangerous way to live. And we become apathetic and indifferent to God. We stop caring about God's plan, God's way, God's will, God's purpose. And we're just driven by our appetites. We're driven by our desires. That's all we care about. We're motivated by what entices us, what's in front of us, not instead driven by the Spirit, driven by God's Spirit. We become comfortable coasting through life, driven by the currents of culture and comfort. So the first attitude that reveals spiritual drift in Samson's life is apathy. The second is entitlement. Entitlement. When Samson tells his parents about the first Philistine girl he wants to marry, they resist Samson. They try to push back a little bit, and his response displays his attitude of entitlement. In Judges chapter 14, verse 3, it says, his father and mother replied, isn't there an acceptable woman among your relatives and among all our people? Must you go to the uncircumcised Philistines to get a wife? Come on, Samson. But Samson said to his father, get her for me. She's the right one for me. get her for me. She's the right one for me. So his parents try to talk some sense into him, but he's not going to listen. He doesn't care what they say. He wants what he wants, and he thinks he deserves whatever he wants, even if it's in direct conflict with God's plan for his life. His entitlement reveals his spiritual drift. His entitlement reveals the spiritual drift in his life. I'm 16. I just turned 16. Where's my new ride? I just graduated college. Where's my new six-figure salary and job? Right? Where's my white picket fence? Where's my bombshell wife? Kind of my favorite is when you're in line at the on-ramp to get on the freeway, right? And there's 78 cars lined up and your car number 78 and someone comes driving by because they're in a hurry, unlike the 78 people in line, and they go all the way to the front and they just cut in right at the last second. Anybody know what I'm talking about? What about at the airport? Oh, I deserve to go in front of everyone because I'm going to miss my flight and I'm so important. I'm an MVP, I'm a VIP. Send me to the front of the line. What about the drop-off line at school, right? You ever seen moms screeching their tires? Yeah, I'm important, let me in, fit me in. Oftentimes I hear people talking about entitlement. They're doing it to take pot shots at the millennial generation, right? Oh, the millennials, they're so entitled. I think entitlement is running rampant in every generation today. In every generation. In fact, I wrote down some indicators of an attitude of entitlement. See if you can relate with any of these. Now, don't think about someone else, okay? Think about yourself here, all right? Number one, that should be the first one, right? If you're thinking about someone else right now, then you're probably entitled. sorry, that just came to me. Number one, you impose unrealistic expectations on your spouse, family, children, parents, or employees. Right? Anybody relate to that? Don't raise your hand. Number two, you believe you deserve happiness and you'll go to whatever lengths necessary to get it. Doesn't matter who you have to hurt. Number three, you punish people when they don't do what you want. Right? If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Oftentimes you punish them passively with the silent treatment, or you gossip about them, or you spread vicious rumors about them. It's convicting, right? Number four, you tend to look out for your own interests and needs and desires almost exclusively. It's all about you. Number five, you impose ultimatums with the threat of removing your friendship or support if things aren't done your way. It's my ball and I'm going home. It's my way or the highway. I think if we're honest, most of us can find at least some traces of entitlement in our attitudes. We pick up the story of Samson later on in Judges chapter 14. Samson is all set to marry this Philistine girl, and there's a huge 7-day wedding party, and Samson decides, you know what, this is pretty fun. The party's getting pretty wild. Let's take it to the next level. Let's take it to the next level. Let's make this even more interesting. And so he decides to make a wild bet with his groomsmen. Now, Samson, the Israelite, Nazirite, set apart by God before the time of his birth for God's purposes, his groomsmen are 30 Philistines. Those are his groomsmen. He decides, you know what, let's make this more interesting. And so he makes a bet. He tells those 30 groomsmen a riddle. And he says, listen, if you can solve this riddle by the end of the 7-day celebration, then I will give each one of you a set of expensive clothes. Really expensive clothes. But if you cannot, then all of you have to bring me a set of expensive clothes. Now, I sort of chuckled when I read that. I'm not a mathematician. I'm just a pastor. But this bet seems really stupid, right? I mean, if Samson loses, he has to go get 30 expensive sets of clothes. But if Samson wins, the 30 guys each only have to get one. And I just wrestle with God, why did you put this in the story? I don't understand the value, the meaning. And something jumped out at me. I think here we see Samson breaking yet another one of his Nazirite vows. This is a wild party. They're celebrating for 7 days. And remember, he's not supposed to drink alcohol. Now he's betting under the influence. And it's a poor bet. It's not a good bet. So his groomsmen can't figure it out for a couple days. So they finally go to his wife-to-be and his father-in-law-to-be, and they tell them, listen, you got to get us the answer to his riddle or else we're going to burn you alive. So they force a hand. So his soon-to-be wife comes and she asks and she's asking and she's asking. And finally her asking turns to crying. And then her crying turns to begging. And then she's sobbing and saying, Samson, if you really loved me, you would tell me the secret to your riddle. And the strong man becomes weak. He tells her what she wants to know. She obviously takes that information right back to the groomsmen. The groomsmen bring him the answer and it sets Samson off. He gets furious. He's not happy about this. So he does what any entitled person does. He goes and kills 30 men, brings back their garments to these 30 groomsmen, and then he leaves the party to pout. And he leaves the party and fine, I'm leaving, I'm out. He leaves, and finally later he decides, I'm going to come back to the party. I'm going to come back and get my wife. And so when he comes back to get his wife, it turns out that her father has given her to one of the 30 groomsmen. So as if he wasn't angry before, he's even more angry now. And so look at his response. Samson said to them, this time I have a right to get even with the Philistines. He said, I will really harm them. So he went out and he caught 300 foxes and tied them tail to tail in pairs. First of all, who can catch 300 foxes? I don't know. I wish I had an answer for that. He then fastened a torch to every pair of tails, lit the torches, and let the foxes loose in the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and standing grain together with the vineyards and olive groves. What a disproportionate form of revenge. Oh, you gave away the woman I was going to marry. So let me destroy your livelihood. Let me destroy all of your crops. Let me ruin everything. His revenge just crushes this village. It ruins their lives. And don't think for a second that the Philistines will ever forget this day. They won't. And this sort of marks the turn in the story when the Philistines decide, we got to get rid of this guy. This guy's dangerous. He just couldn't help himself, though. He had to get revenge. Entitlement is a real struggle for Samson, and now it's going to cost him dearly. But that's the thing about entitlement. When we struggle with entitlement, it cost us something. And eventually it cost us everything. And here's the deal about entitlement. When it takes root in your life, it doesn't just impact you. It actually starts to leak out and to impact other people. If you're going to make yourself the center of everything, you have to destroy relationships. You have to ruin teams, break the hearts of your children, your parents. Your entitlement costs everyone around you dearly. Tyler taught a message a couple weeks ago, and that this little phrase stuck with me. Sin splashes. Sin splashes, and your entitlement will slowly destroy not only your life, but the lives of everyone you care about. Everyone you care about. Judges 15 is about Samson getting revenge on the Philistines, but nothing he does, none of his epic feats, his heroic feats, has anything to do with God's purpose or God's plan in his life. He's not trying to set the Israelites free. He's no deliverer of anyone except himself. Everything he does is about Samson and no one else. So let's pick up the story now at the end of chapter 15, in the last verse of chapter 15, verse 20. It says, Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. This verse, I'm like, what? I've never seen this verse before until studying for this message this week. And this verse jumped out to me. Are you kidding me? So chapters 13, 14, 15, everything that happens in those chapters, totally wild living, totally turning his back on God. But then you have this little verse, this little nugget in this story where Samson is a leader in Israel for 20 years. I thought, what's this about? What is God trying to say? Here's the thing. You don't read about any of Samson's exploits during this 20-year period. None. So Samson is installed as this leader in Israel, yet he does nothing to further God's purpose, God's plan in his life. And here's the deal. when entitlement and apathy are reigning supreme in your life, eventually, even if it's 20 years down the road, they will come to roost in your life. There will be a penalty to pay. Samson's disproportionate revenge hasn't been forgotten, and now his enemies are waiting to destroy him. The third attitude that reveals spiritual drift in Samson's life is an attitude of arrogance. An attitude of arrogance. Samson's struggling, he's drifted really far from God. It's you can sort of sense the impending doom in the story, like something's coming. It's not good. Judges 16 opens by telling us about Samson's affair with a prostitute, again, violating his Nazirite vow. He goes all the way to Gaza, which Gaza, so Timnah earlier, right? Only 4 miles. He accidentally bumps into this Philistine woman, but now he goes to Gaza. Gaza's 25 miles away. So he travels 25 miles and he's searching for a woman, and he finds a prostitute there, has an affair with her. It says the villagers are waiting outside for him to come out so they can kill him. And he comes out, and obviously he misuses the strength God has given him to set himself free. So he escapes. Now, first of all, the Philistines still haven't forgotten his destructive revenge. So what in the world is Samson doing walking right into the headquarters of the enemy, thinking, so strong, I got this. How arrogant can you be to walk into the capital of your enemy and say, it's all good, I can do whatever I want because I'm strong. It's almost like he thinks he's responsible for the strength that we know God has given him. And I think so many times in our lives, we experience some success and we start thinking, well, I really got this figured out. I made some money on that deal. I know what I'm doing. I'm so good at business. I'm so smart. I got this nailed. I got this figured out. And we start bumping our own chest. But the truth is, what do we have if it's not God working? If it's not God doing it? If it's not God giving us strength? God giving us success? Well, Samson has just walked 25 miles into the enemy's lap because he's so arrogant. And here's another crazy thought I had. Earlier, he walks 4 miles and he bumps into sin there. This time, he walks 25 miles. There are roughly 2,000 steps in 1 mile of walking, okay? So 2,000 steps multiplied across 25 miles. Samson has walked 50,000 plus steps to get to Gaza. 50,000. Now, here's the thing. I was sort of thinking about that. 50,000 steps, 50,000 opportunities from God to turn away, to turn back, to get right with God, to say, no, I can't do this. Step number two, this will destroy my marriage. Step number three, this will ruin my business and the lives of the people that work with me. Step number three, no, I can't do this. I know where this leads. I know this will destroy my life and the lives of the people I love most. Step number four, step number five, here's the thing. I don't think any of us ever wake up in the morning and think, you know what? Today's a great day to ruin my life. And I think I'll start with my marriage. It's a good place to start. Or you know what, I think I'll back myself into a really horrible financial situation today. That'll be fun. I think I'll get caught in an illicit affair today. No, that's not how it works. How did Samson get to where he is in the story at this point? He didn't get there overnight. He got there one step at a time. And that's how we get there too. One deliberate, willful step at a time. But listen, no matter how many steps you've taken in the wrong direction, every step is another opportunity to come to your senses, to repent, and to turn back to God. Now we catch up in the story. Samson meets another Philistine woman named Delilah, and he falls for her. Shocking, I know. That Samson would fall for yet another woman. She's trying to hook Samson from the very beginning. She knows there are dollar signs all over this. If I hook Samson, the Philistines are willing to pay a lot to learn the secret of his strength so that they can get rid of him. I'm going to be the one. I'm going to make a fortune off of this. And I'm sure she uses her considerable assets in order to hook him, okay? She's got him hooked. And then the first, the second, and the third times that she asks him for the secret of his strength, Samson lies. He lies to her. And then she would tie him up, and then she would yell, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." And Samson would just get up, and he'd go outside, and he'd just shake the ropes off. Finally, after the third time, the fourth time, she comes and says, "Oh, Samson, how can you tell me that you love me? And then you won't even confide in me." And the weak man, not the strong man God intended him to be, tells her what she wants to know. She takes the information and gives it to the Philistines, and the Philistines capture Samson. Pick up the story in 16, verse 19. It says, after putting him to sleep on her lap, she called for someone to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, excuse me, and so began to subdue him, and his strength left him. Then she called, "Samson, the Philistines are upon you." And he awoke from his sleep and thought, "I'll go out as before and shake myself free." Wow, really interesting moment in this story. Just consider that statement. "I'll go out as before and shake myself free." How arrogant can you be, Samson? It's like he's like, "I've seen this so many times. I got this. I can live this way. I can keep taking these steps down this downward spiral, this drifting away from God spiritually. It's no big deal. I know this drill. I'm not hurting anyone. Nobody will even know. Everybody's doing it. Everybody cheats. It's only one little lie." And pretty soon, you put one step on another and one more and one more and one more. Then you catch up with the last part of verse 20. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. See, that word "myself," Samson thought, "You know what? I'll go out and I'll shake myself free." Samson has forgotten from where his power actually comes, from Almighty God, not from himself. But here's the thing. The second we start believing, "We've got this. I got this. I can do this. I can control it. I can keep going down this path," that's the moment we don't even know it because we're so arrogant, but the Lord has left us. Here's the crazy thing about God. God could have left Samson at any point. It's not like this is the first thing he's done. He's been on this downward spiritual spiral, drifting away from God for his entire life. But yet God stuck with him because of his grace and his mercy. And here's the deal. Even if you are drifting from God, he's still with you. But you don't want to get to the point that Samson does where he says, "I'll shake myself free." Because that's the moment you won't even realize it, but God will have left you. Then we see Samson, they gouge out his eyes. They begin to mock and celebrate his downfall. And the rest of Judges 16 tells us about the celebrations the Philistines have in a temple built for the worship of their false god, Dagon. So they drag him to their temple. There are 5,000 Philistine leaders and generals, important people. It's a VIP party. And they're worshiping their god, Dagon, and they're celebrating. "Oh, Dagon, thanks for delivering Samson into our hands." And then they drag him into the party, say, bring him out so that we can be entertained by him." See what's happening here? The enemy has taken Samson, who was set apart from before the time of his birth, called according to God's purposes, set apart to do incredible things for God. And he's taken that child of God and he's literally dangling him in front of God going, "God, isn't this your man? Isn't this your guy?" The enemy loves to take us, hold us in front of Almighty God and say, "Isn't this your child? Look what I've done to your son. Look what I've done to your daughter. May it never be said of me or of you ever again that the enemy can use us as an item of mockery in the face of our God. Samson was no hero. He wasted his strengths. He wasted the gifts that God had given him. He wasted his life. Ultimately, they lead Samson into the party, and he has a servant put his hands on the two pillars. And even his last prayer to God is selfish. God, give me revenge over my enemies. Let me die with the Philistines. He's no hero. God gives him his strength back for a moment just so he can deal with death blow to the ones who are mocking him to his face. But Samson wasted his life. He missed out on the incredible gift it would be to be used by God. I want to leave you quickly with a couple of quick applications for your life. You know, if you find that you're wrestling with apathy, with indifference in your life, what do? How do you respond? You respond with wholehearted commitment. Let me explain what that means. It means you go back to the basics of what it means to have a relationship with Christ. You say, I'm indifferent to God and the things of God. It no longer impacts my daily life. Well, then you have to invest time every day committing yourself to Him. You go back to the Bible. You read the Bible every day. Not in a religious way, but you read it saying, God, I want to know You. I don't want to be indifferent or apathetic toward You. How do you combat entitlement in your life? You practice an attitude of gratitude. You want to see entitlement get out of your life? Then you start telling God how thankful you are for everything in your life. And you make a list every day, 5 minutes. I'm so thankful for my family. I'm so thankful for my job. So thankful for my church. So thankful for my small group. So thankful, so thankful, so thankful. And you watch entitlement leave your life. You want to combat arrogance, an attitude of arrogance in your life? Ask God to humble you. That's a tough prayer. You ask God, God, humble me. But then you don't just say, God, humble me, and go out and still be the same arrogant jerk you were that morning. You look for opportunities to push other people up to the front. You look for opportunities to celebrate the successes of others. You look for a chance to humble yourself. When you mess up, don't be arrogant about it. You go back and say, I messed up. I'm sorry. You apologize. You ask for forgiveness, even in the workplace. Don't tell yourself, I've got to be arrogant if I'm going to be successful. That's a lie. That's the enemy. You humble yourself before Almighty God, and you ask Him to humble you. And then you find someone and you trust them. You ask them to help you in whatever area you might be struggling. Would you pray with me as we close?